supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. It's been almost 3 years since Uber and Lyft started operating in Philadelphia. As Jim Saxa of WHYY's Plan Philly reports, cabbies are hoping changes to the taxi's flat rate for airport trips will help them stay afloat amid the fierce competition.
The Philadelphia Parking Authority approved expanding the flat rate zones for taxi rides to and from Philadelphia International Airport. Taxi drivers had petitioned the PPA so they could charge the higher flat rate fee on more airport trips. Since Uber and Lyft came to town, the cab industry has withered to about half the size it once was. The bigger zone should help. The larger zone will cover more turf in University City and extend to Washington Avenue in South Philly. Drivers also asked the PPA to raise fares, but that proposal was tabled. Originally, taxis had asked for several other changes, but many of them were later withdrawn. While Uber and Lyft were originally deemed illegal hack taxis in Philadelphia, in November, Governor Wolf signed a law authorizing them and imposing regulations. Jim Saxa, WHYY News.
While North Carolina's so-called bathroom bill has gotten the most attention, 16 other states have considered measures defining gender for purposes of public restroom use and restricting those who identify as transgender from using the bathroom they want. But gender nonconforming Americans face unique difficulties across a broad array of services, programs, and facilities, from driver's licenses to college admissions to sports teams. In his new book, Beyond Trans, Does Gender Matter?, Temple political science professor Heath Fogg Davis, himself a transgender man, argues we should stop using gender definitions in public policy. Heath, thanks for joining me on NewsWorks Tonight.
It's great to be here.
What you're calling for is a fairly fundamental rethinking of gender.
Yes. I want for us to ask this question, does gender matter, in a whole slew of venues that we typically take it for granted that gender does matter. And this issue is at the forefront right now. California is poised to consider allowing for a third gender option on its government-issued IDs. Oregon is similarly considering this. So the time has come for this topic to really be discussed. And while I think that those measures are important progressive steps, I don't think that they go far enough. So I would call upon states to really question the necessity, the usefulness of having male or female gender stickers or markers on identity documents in the first place, because, as I argue in the book, they're not clearly connected to a good policy purpose. So with respect to government-issued IDs, you can think about what's the point of having gender on those cards. It's to verify that we are who we say we are in situations where the potential for identity fraud is high and the consequences are grave. However, gender is not a very good way of keeping track of our personal identity. There are other better ways of doing this, and banks and other places have come up with passwords, biometric forms of verifying who you say you are. I find in the book, when I did the research here, sometimes gender matters when it comes to public policy, but more often than not, it doesn't.
Though, can this thinking run concurrently with grassroots advocacy for many aspects of gender equality, and pay disparity comes to mind?
Yeah, that's a really interesting issue. And when I kind of, when I talk about this issue and I want to question the use of gender in such a fundamental way, people often ask, well, are there any instances when it makes sense, when you would say, yes, we should pay attention to gender? And I think that issues of gender equity in terms of pay and the workplace, those are issues where you do want to keep track of certain gender-related experiences. So that makes sense from a statistical perspective, keeping track of how much women are paid with respect to men. But then when you have a policy, when you take gender into consideration, I think you have to be very explicit and careful about how you define gender. So who counts as a woman, who counts as a man, even for the purposes of aggregate statistics related to affirmative action. The main reason why I think that we should get rid of you know, the gender markers in a lot of these cases is because whenever you have a gender policy on the books, you have to then administrate it, which means that you have somebody who's an administrative agent who then has the power to decide whether you meet that person's own subjective standards, because there's nothing written down for being a man or a woman. You know, so when you think about like a restaurant situation, I talk about this example in the book. Often it will come down to the restaurant's manager. You know, they get a report. There's a man in the women's bathroom. This was the case that I talk about in that chapter. Then somebody has to come in and investigate, you know, and in that case, it ended up being the bouncer from the bar who came in, banged on the door. This, you know, masculine presenting woman was using the women's restroom and demanded that she leave. And in that case, it was really alarming because the person, Khadijah Farmer, actually offered to show the bouncer her driver's license, a New York driver's license, which had a female gender marker on it, which would seem to validate, but it wasn't. It wasn't enough in that situation. And I think what's really interesting and kind of chilling about that story is that the fact that the sex-marked ID, government-issued ID, was not sufficient in that case tells us that there's a lot more going on there, so that the individual had already made their mind up about this person and was going to eject this person from the restaurant no matter what kind of evidence she showed. So this is really an issue about gender policing, about policing the sort of who fits and who doesn't fit within these categories. And it's interlaced with homophobia, about the assumptions that we make based on, say, a masculine presenting woman, that she's a lesbian, or a feminine presenting man, that he's gay. And so homophobia and transphobia really collide in a lot of these scenarios.
Heath, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Heath Fogg Davis, Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple University and author of the new book entitled Beyond Trans, Does Gender Matter? You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. This weekend, America's oldest outdoor art show takes place in Philadelphia as the Rittenhouse Square Fine Art Show celebrates its 90th year. And for the first time, the competitive exhibition will be featuring art by formerly homeless people. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports.
The Rittenhouse Square Fine Art Show is one of the most prestigious open-air markets in the country. To maintain its high standards, all the artists are vetted, and they must abide by a long list of rules. When the idea was floated to invite formerly homeless people from Project Home, board member Sandra Sedmak-Engel said there was some initial hesitation.
We wanted to make sure bringing in another organization was going to stay on the same level as the rest of the exhibitors.
2 years ago, Project Home struck up a partnership with a small art school called Studio Incaminati, specializing in classical realist art. Residents could take art classes 4 hours a week. Cassandra Presley, who used to be homeless, signed up with 1 foot pointed to the exit.
I had already planned an escape plan to get out of the classes. And the first thing that we had to draw, you know, I liked it. It's just, you know, just jumped out at me, you know. It's just something that I wanted to get involved in.
The Project Home students receive the same level of instruction as full-time students, just less of it. And the task is simple. Draw what you see. That's much harder than it sounds, says Wesley Mitchell, standing in front of an arrangement of rag dolls on a chair.
Actually trying to capture what's really there. Like, sometimes my mind gets in the way, and I'll already have a preconceived thing of what a doll is. And then I want to draw that rather than what's right there.
Basic lessons of art can sometimes seem like basic lessons of life. Mitchell is a recovering alcoholic. He spent some time in state prison. He's now living on disability benefits, and he signed up for art classes because too much idle time can be dangerous for an alcoholic.
Actually, my favorite tool that we have in our box is my eraser. It took me 3 weeks to understand that. It was like I was married to every stroke. I couldn't let it go. Just like in my big thing in my life, I had to learn that I just can't drink successfully, you know? And it took me a lifetime to understand that. So I've just let that go.
While these art classes have been personally therapeutic for the residents of Project Home, instructor Rachel Pearson says it's the quality of their work that got them invited to the show in Rittenhouse Square.
The skill to actually render something accurately. There's a sort of sense of accomplishment that comes with it, but also I'm trying to take them all the way to be professional. And I think, okay, I'm biased, that people are going to be very impressed with the work.
The Rittenhouse Square Fine Art Show is rain or shine. That means all participants, from professionals to students to the formerly homeless, are required to stick it out, regardless of the weather. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Many Americans have been scratching their heads since the presidential election with questions about the way government works and how it's supposed to work. One Philadelphia public school teacher is on a mission to answer those questions and create better informed citizens. For WHYY, Rob Zavatsky reports a few drinks help the civics lessons go down.
There was no centralized government under the Articles of Confederation to actually mediate this problem. The reason why is because a central government smacked of a king.
Usually, topics like federalism are reserved for the classroom. On the second Thursday of the month, people fill the seats of National Mechanics in Philadelphia's Old City for a lesson in participatory democracy.
So it made sense in theory, but in practice it was a big, big mess. See Shay's Rebellion. Which is not the first time, nor the last time, that a bunch of angry white men make a mess.
It's called Civics on Tap. It combines a civics and history lesson with beer. Grace Palladino is the driving force behind the event.
I am, in fact, a high school teacher in Philadelphia, and I teach civics and government, and thank you very much.
Palladino has been a teacher for about a decade. She says schools don't spend a lot of time teaching students about citizenship, so she isn't surprised that more and more adults have been asking her questions in the wake of the 2016 presidential election.
Pretty safe to assume that you haven't really received any civics and government prior to senior year, and sometimes not even then. So there's no, like, base knowledge of the intricacies of how government works.
Matt Slusser is one of the organizers of Civics on Tap. He belongs to a South Philly political action group run by Palladino. He says since President Trump took office, more people have been looking for ways to get involved with politics. But they don't really understand how it works.
We're just seeing like a low level of education around kind of like who your state rep was. So it's like, you know, people are saying like, what can I do? And we'll say like, you know, contact your state representative. And they're like, well, I don't know who that is. And it's like, well, what district do you live in? And they're like, I'm not entirely sure.
Civics on Tap is their way of helping educate voters without being heavy-handed. Palladino tells jokes about what could be dry topics, and Slusser creates attractive and witty slides to go along with her talking points.
So it was just kind of trying to figure out what we can do and how we can give people that level of information without it being, like, boring. So we were able to kind of, like, engage a little bit more by doing it at a bar and having some, like, kind of, like, fun with it.
Kate Lynch came to Civics on Tap on the recommendation of a friend. She says the recent election was a wake-up call for her.
I think people are amazed that the things that are happening can actually happen because I think everyone is lulled into this sense of, oh, well, that will be fine. That could never happen. And then you're like, oh my gosh, that's actually happening.
Lynch appreciates Palladino can give her the civics primer she never got.
I think that I need to know more about civics than I do right now in terms of actually how the government works.
Palladino plans her lessons based on relevance and urgency. Lecture topics have included the Electoral College, gerrymandering, federalism, and even the Philadelphia District Attorney's race. She knows the subject matter can be dense and daunting, so she tries her best to keep the lessons entertaining. Joe Johnson is a regular at Civics on Tap. She says Palladino's passion is infectious.
She is the history teacher we never got when we were in high school. She has a way of educating you on things that you never thought you wanted to learn about, and then you're excited to learn about them.
Josh Godick has attended every session of Civics on Tap since it started in January. He says he keeps coming back because it's more than just an old-fashioned history lesson.
There's like a lot of discussion topics that come up. Not everything is just a fact that I didn't know. It's more a feeling that sparks a discussion between people.
Palladino has been interested in politics since she was quite young and might even consider running for office.
I would never stand back and preach to others to get more involved and not also embody that as well.
In the meantime, she'll keep her day job and keep leading Civics on Tap. For WHYY, I'm Rob Zavatsky.
New research shows that in order for some early birds to catch the worm, they have to breed sooner in the spring. The Allegheny Front's Kara Holsapple has more.
Luke DeGroat is the avian research coordinator at Carnegie Museum of Natural History, and he runs the bird banding program at their Powder Mill Nature Reserve in Westmoreland County. Right now, he's in the thick of spring migration.
It's sort of a bit like fishing in a way. We put out our nets to see what we catch.
From early in the morning until about noon, he and a handful of volunteers patrol a series of nets, kind of like volleyball nets that are set up around the property.
This is a red-winged blackbird. I'm going to grab him by the body and very carefully pull the netting over the tip of the wing.
Birds like this little guy with a distinctive red patch on its wing get caught up in the fine netting and drop down into a pocket where they're scooped up by researchers.
The red-winged blackbirds tend to hold on tight.
He's really clinging on.
When it's finally freed, DeGroat gingerly places the bird into a bag, like a small pillowcase, and loops its string to a red carabiner around his neck. Red indicates which size metal band to place around the blackbird's leg, so it can be tracked.
I'm heading to three. If anyone wants to check the edge of the ponds, that'd be great.
All the birds they capture this morning and every morning are taken back to a small lab where they're banded with a unique number and weighed. Researchers also examine their feathers to determine age and if the birds are getting ready to breed.
The females, when they're in breeding condition, will lose the feathers on the breast and insert some fluid to create really like a hot water bottle for the eggs.
They've been collecting these data here at Powder Mill consistently for over 50 years. That's how they know from previous studies that birds are migrating here a little earlier in the spring than they used to and breeding sooner. And that got DeGroat and his research partner, Molly McDermott, thinking.
All right, if they're migrating early and they're breeding early, are they breeding earlier because they're migrating early? Or are they breeding more quickly after they arrive?
So what did you find?
Yeah, they're basically getting busier earlier after arrival.
That's true for the majority of the 17 common bird species they studied. In their recent paper published in the journal PLOS ONE, they connect early breeding to warmer springs and climate change. Because while birds are arriving here a day earlier for every 1 degree Celsius that the temperature has warmed over the last few decades, spring buds are opening 3 days earlier. Those plants and the insects birds rely on for food, for the survival of their young, are now sort of mismatched with the timing of spring migration. So these birds are responding the only way they can.
They're having to catch up because they're not able to catch up during migration. They're not able to sort of advance that as much as the plants. They have to begin breeding soon after arrival. If they want to breed at a time period, that's sort of what they're used to.
When the tender plants and insects they eat are at their peak. A quarter of the species which bred earlier in this study, like black-capped chickadees, had more babies in these warmer years. But another 25%, including hooded warblers, didn't. Their productivity declined. DeGroat says you can look at the results of this study two ways. On the glass-half-full side, it shows some bird species are flexible and capable of adapting to climate change. But while weather isn't climate, a few years ago there was a hard winter and later spring, this year is warmer, he says the overall trend for birds is worrying.
If it continues to warm, that window which they have to be adaptable is shrinking.
This most recent study just looks at the timing of bird breeding, but DeGroat says it's easy to see the implications for the ecosystem. If some species are less successful because of climate change, there might be fewer birds to pick off insects or spread seeds from the fruits they eat. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Kara Holsapple.
The Allegheny Front reports on environmental issues in Pennsylvania. Forget Eagles versus Steelers. There's one rivalry that really divides Pennsylvania. It's the convenience store wars, Wawa versus Sheetz. But these two Pennsylvania companies actually have a lot in common, including their important role in Pennsylvania's economy. Keystone Crossroads' Eleanor Klibanoff reports.
To people outside Pennsylvania, it might seem a little crazy to talk about a convenience store like this.
Wawa tastes better. They have their homemade rolls and make the sandwiches right there. It just tastes better. I'm from central Pennsylvania, and Sheetz is all they have.
And we stopped at a Wawa, and I didn't like it. There was no welcoming.
No, yeah. So you wouldn't go back?
No, I would not go back.
I hit the one up the mountain in Crescent if I don't make it to the Sheetz in Altoona. But yeah, I'm always in Sheetz.
It's fine. It's a poor man's Wawa, but it's like the same concept as Wawa with the sandwiches and then other convenience foods. But, I mean, nobody can beat Wawa's.
Kim Swaljay, Karen Rhodes, Brenda Lisden, and Ben Lampe are all Pennsylvanians. But more deeply, they identify as being from Sheetz territory or Wawa country. The two chains are different. Sheetz is a little more fun with bright colors and loud music, while Wawa offers service in a sedate setting. Wawa's goal is to give people the best 3 minutes of their day, while Sheetz is expanding seating options and offering Wi-Fi. Here's Joe Sheetz, president and CEO of the third-generation family business.
We're in smaller towns, and in a lot of those places, we're kind of the general store, the corner store. Sometimes we're the social center of that small town where people meet.
But beyond that, the companies are basically exactly the same. They're both industry leaders, expanding quickly, and often rank high on national best employer lists. And it's not just that. Listen to Joe Sheets and Wawa spokeswoman Lori Bruce talk about the origins of their respective companies.
My great-grandfather started a dairy in Altoona in the early 1900s.
In 1902, George Wood started the Wawa Dairy.
And one of those dairy stores was purchased by my Uncle Bob and separated from the dairy into a new venture that eventually became Sheetz, and that was in 1952.
And Graham Wood launched our original store in Folsom, Delaware County, Pennsylvania in 1964.
Both companies have expanded into 5 other states. Wawa has over 700 stores, while Sheetz has 500. But they both remain headquartered in their original communities. Joe Sheetz says more stores elsewhere means more jobs locally, in Altoona and Blair County as a whole.
I don't think we're the reason that Blair County is a great place to live, but I'd like to think that the jobs we've been able to create, particularly the jobs in the last 15 years, not only well-paying jobs, but lots of career opportunities that we've been able to provide people in this geography.
Starting wages are $9 an hour for Sheetz and $10 an hour for Wawa. Both companies have thousands of store employees in Pennsylvania, from part-time entry-level staff to managers who make over $75,000 a year. And they offer health insurance, 401ks, and advancement opportunities. Wawa has an employee stock ownership program, while Sheetz has tuition reimbursement for employees attending college. Beyond jobs, Sheetz's impact can be seen just by driving around Altoona. There's the Sheetz Family Health Center, the Sheetz Center for Entrepreneurial Excellence, and Penn State Altoona's Sheetz Fellows program. And at Wawa, Lori Bruce says the company donates to food banks and local organizations.
In regard to Pennsylvania specifically, in 2016 alone, Wawa and the Wawa Foundation contributed more than $5 million.
Both companies see Pennsylvania as the place that gave them their start, and they're happy to give back. They're also happy to stick to their side of the state. In fact, company executives are pretty amused by the rivalry that's emerged between their customers. But maybe, just maybe, that rivalry is what unites us, after all. To be a Sheetz freak or have goose blood in your veins is to be a Pennsylvanian, fanatically obsessed with your convenience store chain of choice. Eleanor Klibanoff, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY is the lead station. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.